You're probably familiar with the doctor-patient confidentiality agreement, but does that rule apply if a patient tells the doctor that he murdered someone years ago? Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our next guest is Dr. Jacob Apple. He is the author of the new book, Who Says You're Dead? He teaches bioethics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, where he is director of ethics education in psychiatry. He's also an attending psychiatrist in the Mount Sinai healthcare system. In the book, he explores hypothetical and real scenarios dealing with genetic screening, sexuality, privacy. I was amazed at the number of ethical issues that can come up in today's healthcare industry. And I hope you'll join in the conversation. Maybe you are aware of a situation that you wonder about. Give us a call with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jacob Apel, I believe, is the is that how you pronounce your name, Dr. Apel?
Yes, it is, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. Once again, my jaw dropped when I started looking through the your book. It's a fascinating read. You've been teaching ethics for 2 decades. Have student attitudes about ethics changed over that time, I'm wondering?
Unfortunately, I think the whole culture's attitudes toward ethics have changed, and you slowly see it percolating in the students as well. I think more and more, because we live in a very bifurcated or fissured society, we think people who disagree with us are not simply wrong or misguided, but they're evil or their intentions aren't good. So part of my book's goal is, when we think about complex ethical issues, about the beginning of life, the end of life, is to realize that people who disagree with us may not share our values, but they're well-intentioned people, because that's the only way we can have meaningful discourse about really complex subjects.
What about your own view? How has your own view of ethics and how it fits into medicine changed over the years?
Well, I actually came to medicine later than I came to ethics. So I taught bioethics for almost a decade at Brown before I was a physician, then went back and became a physician. So I have a double lens on it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In that I thought I knew more than I did when I was teaching, and then when I became a physician, I developed a whole new viewpoint. And you realize that anytime you think you know the right answer in these issues, there's always another viewpoint and another complexity that can arise.
Yeah, and you also have a law degree, and I expect that must have been important for you to get one.
Well, what I tell people is I now have 9 graduate degrees, but to my mother, I will always be her son who's not the rabbi, so I can never catch up.
Oh, man. Well, let's talk about the book and what made you decide to write it right now.
Sure. So I've had these ideas and been interested in writing about this for a long time, but I needed the experience and I needed to gather enough interesting cases over the years, and eventually we had about 150 cases, and we pared them down to what I think are the 79 most interesting. And granted, the odds of any one of these ethical issues arising for one of your listeners is low, but having a framework to talk about the issues is essential, because some issue like this is very likely to arise in their lives during the course of their lifetime.
Well, and you've kind of broken the book into various sections, body parts, making babies, practical matters, for the good of the many, and in each of those areas you bring up circumstances, and I think, you know, the breakthroughs, and you talk about this, the breakthroughs and the rapid breakthroughs in medicine have created many moral and ethical challenges maybe that we didn't have to deal with even 20 years ago.
I mean, the change is occurring as we speak. I imagine many of your listeners are in their cars right now. Some of them are at work. If I asked them how many of them locked their doors before they left for work, most of them would say yes. If if I asked them how many of them dusted off their doorknobs for DNA, most of them would say no. And yet DNA theft is perfectly legal in a number of states, and you can take that DNA from a stranger and do all sorts of complex things with it. You can discover their genetic history, their medical history. You can share it with other people. Now you can use it to solve crimes. So even in our daily lives, the implications of rapidly advancing technology are transformative.
Yeah, it's amazing. I liked your title. It caught my eye. Who Says Your Dad? It's a great title. How did that come about?
Thank you. Well, I think one of the most challenging issues in bioethics is when you ask the students outright, what does it mean to be dead? They have a very concrete, obvious issue. We all have some sense of it. But then when you explore it, it becomes much more complicated. For example, 48 states now view brain death, full complete brain death, as legal death. However, there are individual families and religious communities that don't accept that definition. So what do you do, and this has happened a number of times, when the family will raise money and want to bring their legally brain-dead child or loved one home on life support, keep them alive in their living room, for example, which occurred in one case. Now, if I wanted to bring my deceased grandmother home and embalm her like Lenin in my living room, we wouldn't let me do that. But how do you parse out those cases, which are very gray? I'll also add that this has been a historical issue even before the rise of bioethics, because you may be dead for one purpose and not for another. There are all sorts of cases that people are lost at sea and then come back many years later and their property's been given away and their spouse is remarried. To what degree can they reclaim their rights when they're refound?
Oh, man.
You think that's funny? This recently happened. A man in Romania had gone to work in Turkey, and his wife had legally declared him dead. And many years later, he returned. But since he was legally dead in Romania, he was unable to get a job, hold an apartment, and he couldn't get the courts to reverse the decision.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, what ethical can you mention the ethical dilemma that proved to be the most interesting to you personally?
Sure. So I will tell you the one that I think spawns the most debate among the students. It's actually the first dilemma in the book. It involves a individual who comes forward to see whether he is a potential donor for his father for a kidney donation. And the discovery is there's bad news and there's worse news. Not only is he not a potential donor, but he's also not his father's son. And then the question arises, should the hospital share this and under what circumstances? And if you think that's challenging, after the students think that through, or hopefully your audience will think that through and come up to a decision, then imagine it's a husband and wife who come forward, and the goal is to discover whether or not, even though they're not related, they could still be matches for a kidney donation. And the hospital discovers there's good news and there's better news, so to speak. Not only are they a potential match, but they actually have siblings or siblings and don't know it, should they be told.
Oh. Well, and you know what I found interesting in your book, and you list all these very interesting ethical issues. You don't provide an answer.
No, I mean the truth is there is often an answer for each individual, and one of the things I emphasize to both students and patients is the goal is for them to figure out the right answer for themselves. To believe there is an answer to any of these questions with a capital A or truth with a capital T, even if you believe in that more generally, misses the point. These issues are just too complex for there to be a clear right answer.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. The one that I mentioned in my introduction to you had to do with I think was probably an actual case of a guy, probably a good, seemingly good guy, who admits to his doctor that he killed somebody, you know, like 30 years earlier or 20 years earlier when he was a young kid. It was a mistake, but he did it.
And there are all sorts of permutations of that. What if it's not just that he killed someone, but he killed someone and the family isn't certain what happened, whether that person is a missing person and remains looking for them? Can the physician then reveal the information? If the goal is to prevent future harms, but not to penalize people for past damage, which is the law in most states, is the family searching for their lost loved one a future harm?
Yeah, it's one of those where you wonder, wow. And I guess it's probably, maybe it's an individual thing. I mean, but the doctor was specifically told in that instance not to tell anybody.
Well, I think there's a wide range of what you can tell and what you should tell and what you shouldn't. And we could sit in the room for hours with a dozen people and come up with 13 different opinions. Some things we as a society all accept should be shared. If somebody comes forward and says they've been abused, they're a child, they're abused, that we share. But if someone comes forward and tells you that they had a romantic relationship with their previous psychiatrist, which is a clear violation of all ethical guidelines, can you report that to the state? Fairly often.
As I said, you kind of present both sides of the argument relating to the ethical issue. How difficult was that to write neutrally? I wondered about that.
So one of the advantages I have is that I've taught many of these cases for many years. So when teaching the students, the goal is to be as neutral as possible. And I know that if the scenarios play in one direction or another, I recalibrate them the next year. So they're designed to be perfectly balanced.
Well, we will definitely be going through some of the ethical issues with our guest today, Dr. Jacob Appel, who is the author of Who Says You're Dead? He is teaches bioethics at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, where he directs ethics education in psychiatry and also an attending psychiatrist in the Mount Sinai healthcare system. Give you a chance to join in. Is there an issue maybe that relates to you or just one that you have a question about? I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else more is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guest. You stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at ethical dilemmas facing the medicine field today with our guest, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Dr. Jacob Appel. He is the author of the new book just out today, as a matter of fact. It's titled, Who Says You're Dead? He teaches bioethics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Director of Ethics Education as well. He's also an attending psychiatrist in the Mount Sinai healthcare system. So, what ethical questions do you have for him? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Appel, we're going to go to a caller right away. Josh in Milwaukee has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Josh. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I was curious if your guest would comment on it. So personally, it's actually against my religious view to vaccinate my children. And so I was wondering if he had ever dug into the topic of the ethics as to whether it's ethical to force people to be vaccinated. My community has to rely on the herd immunity where, you know, everybody's vaccinated around us and we just kind of huddle inside the group and keep clean as possible and stay distant as possible. But we also send our kids to public schools and things still. There is some worry that, you know, we may be forced to homeschool or that they, you know, may even get as extreme as trying to, you know, force us to vaccinate our children or even accuse us of not taking care of our children by refusing to vaccinate. I was wondering if you'd be willing to comment on that.
Josh,
sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I think the challenge here is when someone has a key religious belief that only affects them personally, it's very easy to say, let them make that choice. even when the implications are just for their family, barring certain extreme levels, it's very easy for society to say, this is something that is your business, you don't interfere with our lives, we don't interfere with yours. So, for example, we let the Amish homeschool their children and do carpentry. We don't force them to absorb the Western curricula because we know that that's their life and their prerogative. What becomes more challenging is when individual choices that are sincere have an impact on the public health. And the challenge with vaccination is if enough people don't get vaccinated for certain diseases, then the herd immunity drops in the community, the number of people vaccinated. And people who even have been vaccinated, but the vaccine hasn't taken effectively, then become susceptible. So you impose some danger, and we could have a more scientific debate on what degree, on innocent bystanders. I'm not saying whether society should tolerate that or shouldn't, but I think that's the challenge. How much risk do we allow people's sincere religious belief to impose upon innocent third parties?
You know, there was an example in your book that I thought was interesting that relates to what Josh was talking about. And this was the example of a doctor who's visiting with somebody who says, well, I'm not vaccinating my child. And the doctor, whether or not the doctor could say to that person, well, then you have to go to somebody else for your health care because I don't want an unvaccinated child in my office.
Yes, the question of whether or not doctors can choose their own patients, it's been one that has challenged professions for generations. It seems fairly clear to people that barbers can choose their own clients, barring certain very specific categories of discrimination. You don't like my haircut, you don't want to cut my hair, that's your prerogative, because there can be an infinite number of barbers. In contrast, doctors are more like taxi medallions or liquor licenses in some jurisdictions, or radio waves. There are a limited number, partially defined by the government to government funding and regulation, which means that they both have a role in the market, but they also have a special privilege. So to what degree will we allow people to opt out of offering services, either specific services like reproductive health services, like birth control, like assisted suicide? And on the other hand, whether we let them opt out of treating certain patients, like those who haven't vaccinated, is a very challenging one. In this case, this physician may have some moral principle involved, or on the other hand, or some religious value of his own, or he may be concerned for the health and safety of other patients in his waiting room. For example, if another patient, a pediatric patient, comes to his clinic and contracts a disease like measles from an unvaccinated child, is that doctor then morally or ethically culpable?
Yeah, man, oh, man, oh, man. Just to deal with that on a day-to-day basis, and you know what? We all have, I think there are times in probably everyone's life where they have an ethical dilemma of one sort or another. What advice do you have for people dealing with an ethical dilemma?
That's the only easy question I ever get. And what I tell people is that bioethicists like myself are great people. You should meet us at weddings. You should meet us at parties. The one place you don't want to meet us is in the hospital. The best way to avoid meeting us in the hospital is to think about these questions in advance, to talk to your loved ones, to talk to your children, to figure out in certain wide likely parameters of what may happen to you if you get sick, what you would want done. There's a lot of talk about advanced directives, about living wills, but far more important than simply documentation is having meaningful conversations with the people around you and thinking through yourself what you would want done in challenging situations.
Yeah, and you pose a number of those. I was remembering one where a kind of an outdoors guy caught something. I forget what it was now, but he was you know, kind of on his deathbed, and the treatments could possibly leave him paralyzed or whatever. And he had two sisters, and one said he wouldn't want that. He, you know, let him go, and the other said, no, he should, you know, do everything you can to save his life.
So I also tell people, beyond doing yourself a good deed or a service by figuring out your values in advance and discussing them with your friends and family, you're doing your loved ones a service. The last thing your loved ones need in a challenging and fraught situation you'd have to figure out what you would have wanted done, and even worse, to generate conflict between them. So if everybody's on the same page, even though the decisions are hard, the ethical dilemmas are easy.
Yeah. What part does ethics play in medicine, the practice of medicine?
So I think the largest role that ethics plays in terms of the kind of work I do is ethics consultants are called to offer guidance or framework to patients facing these challenging choices, to their families facing these choices. In my experience, people rarely want a concrete answer. They don't want you to say, do this, don't do that. They want permission. They have an understanding of what their values are, and they want someone to say to them, this is okay. Science won't judge you. Medicine won't judge you. Ethics won't judge you. And they often want someone just to sit down with them and listen and help them figure out what they would want done in a very challenging circumstance.
That makes good sense to me, for sure. Let's talk about a few of the scenarios you talk about in your book. We kind of touched on doctor-patient confidentiality and if it still applies to about relating to murder. What are some other issues? I'm remembering some that I just, my jaw dropped when I, you know, a woman comes in and says she wants her foot amputated.
Yeah, so elective limb amputation is a fascinating and challenging phenomenon. It's a very rare either disorder or condition or preference, but there are people who will come forward who say that in the same way that some people say that they were born in bodies of the wrong gender and want gender reassignment surgery, don't feel that a particular limb is neurologically attached to them. One surgeon in Scotland, Robert Smith, actually did either one or, I believe, two procedures doing this on patients. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, you're doing significant damage to these people. It's irreversible. Maybe they haven't been fully vetted effectively. Maybe this will be treatable in a different way in the future. On the other hand, if there's a high risk these people will try this on their own at much greater risk, are you actually doing them a health service by amputating their foot in a sterile operating room versus letting them lie down in a train track, which people do, and risking their own lives and the lives of others?
Oh, man. And another, that just to bring in another area of the conversation relating to body parts, organs for celebrities. That was the chapter of one of your scenarios. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So a question arises about who should get organs and under what circumstances. There's a significant scarcity of organs, but the equity in the system is considered really important. The perception that people, on the one hand, are equally likely and equal need to get an organ. On the other hand, we know with other diseases that a high-profile celebrity benefiting from treatment or announcing they have a particular disorder generates much more interest. You could think, for example, of Michael J. Fox and Parkinson's disease. So seeing a very famous person succeed with an organ transplant certainly is likely to generate more interest and might even generate more donations. How do you balance all that out? And finally, what criteria should you use? Historically, in the 1960s, Swedish Hospital in Seattle, for its dialysis machines, used the social worth of the patient to decide who would get treatment.
Ooh.
You're very uncomfortable doing that, but is there some threshold beyond which we wouldn't give you an organ? So the extreme example I use for those people who say, well, everybody deserves an equal opportunity. If you are on death row and you need a transplant, a kidney transplant, a liver transplant, which will be paid for by the government, and we know that your life expectancy on death row will exceed the life expectancy of the organ, which it will, should we give you one?
Yeah. What would you...
I don't have an answer to that. These are not easy questions.
Yeah, they're not easy questions. By the way, if you'd like to join in with your own comment, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. The other issue that that caught my eye in that segment was voluntary castration.
Sure. So there is a belief, at least in some sex therapy and sex treatment communities for sex offenders, that voluntary castration, either physical or chemical, will reduce the likelihood of recidivism of sex offenders, which is something I think all of us could agree is a desirable thing.
Yeah.
So should we offer prisoners who committed sex offenses the opportunity for early release or parole on the condition that they agree to forcible castration? And some prisoners would take that up, and I imagine their likelihood of recidivism would be much lower. But if you think that's an okay thing, you can think about other things we draw a line in the sand and never do. If you were a thief and we agreed to cut your hand off so you would be stigmatized and not do it again, society would never tolerate that. Except maybe in Saudi Arabia, but not in the United States.
Yeah, I was going to say, it happens in Saudi Arabia, or at least has happened in Saudi Arabia, where a person's, if they're right-handed, their right hand is chopped off. And the other one that I thought was quite, what do you do, was the family that came and they wanted the doctors to make it so their daughter would stop growing, that she would remain a small person because of her condition.
Right. So that is known as the Pillow Angel case, which was a specific case that drew a number of headlines a few years ago. But there have been many similar cases like it. Young children who have severe cognitive impairment, whose parents feel that if they stunt their growth and often reduce their likelihood to grow full sexual features, they will be able to care for these children better when they become adults. They'll reduce their likelihood of becoming victims of sexual offenses. A full-grown woman in a nursing home with the body of a three-year-old is unfortunately a target for malevolent people. So in order to prevent that, they often curtail their growth, stymie their growth hormone. Is that an ethical thing to do, or is that the kind of invasive procedure we would not allow? Keeping in mind, the families here are clearly well-intentioned. But is there something we just as a civilization say, no matter how good your intentions, we don't accept?
I was trying to remember what happened in that specific and well-documented case.
In the very well-documented case, the procedure was done. At least in the short term, the family was very pleased with what happened, but there was a very significant media backlash, and one of the lead physicians involved actually committed suicide shortly thereafter.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That is really, really, really too bad. And that just goes to show the anguish that comes to a doctor or the people involved in the medical issue, how gut-wrenching this all has to be for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, these are issues that when you read about them at home with your spouse and your children can often be funny. And in my book, I try to make them interesting and entertaining and use examples from movies and from the media and from celebrities. But often in the hospital, they're deeply, deeply gut-wrenching decisions, and it's important to remember these affect the real lives of real people.
Yeah, that's for sure. I remember one of your pieces, you know, there's a whole section on children, making babies, that you have in your book. And maybe pick one of those examples that's close to you.
Sure. So I think one of the most interesting ones for me is deaf couples who view deaf as a culture and deafness as a community, who seek to use genetic interventions to ensure that their offspring are also deaf. Now, if you had a child born who you wanted to impair the hearing of, we would view that as child abuse, or many would. On the other hand, if you want to use genetic manipulation to make a hearing child deaf in utero or pre-implantation genetic transformation, should we allow that? So the most famous example of this is actually a British couple, Paula and Tom Lickey, who were deaf, who had one deaf daughter and wanted a second deaf daughter. And the British Fertility Board told them they couldn't do this. Either fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your vantage point, they had a second daughter biologically, and she turned out also to be deaf, for which they are very grateful.
Oh my gosh. And the other area that I thought, well, they were, all these areas were interesting, but for the good of the many, you know, just balancing the welfare of the individual against the collective good. You talk a little bit about that with our caller who asked about vaccination, but talk some more about that.
Sure. So I think many decisions we make that we think only affect ourselves actually have collective impact. So they can be engaging in high-risk behaviors that generate increased healthcare costs, or at the more extreme, they can be examples that require quarantine. So if you have either a rare infectious condition like typhoid Mary did, or like a patient with Ebola or SARS, to what degree and how long should we be able to quarantine you away from society when you've done absolutely nothing wrong? So there are patients who contract tuberculosis who are drug resistant and need to be quarantined through no fault of their own. Is it acceptable to keep you in a tuberculosis jail for a prolonged period of time? Or if you come back from a foreign country and carry a dangerous pathogen, how long can we keep you out of society?
Yeah, that's a big issue. And then even probably more apparent in society would be the alcoholic. Should we move, make chronic alcoholics go into rehabilitation?
Sure. So in part of my job, I do psychiatric emergency room work. And there are patients who I see literally 3 or 4 times a week who are drunk and whose lives have fallen apart and who end up living on the streets and who do not want rehab, detox, want it briefly and then leave. At what point does both the cost of society and the impact on this individual give society the right to step back and say, at least one time you have to try 6 months in rehab, or we need to try a cure on you, even if you don't want it, because you may look back and say, thank you for letting me do that.
Yeah, yeah. Mike in Minocqua has something for us. Mike, hello.
I wanted to talk about the concept of brain death. We've heard about people moving their families to other hospitals or even across the country to get a different opinion. I was just wondering what his take was on that and why it's so difficult to define brain death.
Sure. So I mentioned a bit about this earlier, in the sense that there are some families, some communities that don't accept brain death. Death is not an intuitive concept. It's not like you hold a mirror up in front of the corpse and see whether you get breath and vapor on the glass. So as long as we live in a complex, pluralistic society, we're going to have different people with different sets of values. And the question is, to what degree do we impose one norm upon all of them? And death, by the way, is not just a concept that has medical implications. But whether or not you're dead impacts whether or not your spouse can remarry, whether or not your children can inherit, whether or not the government keeps paying you benefits. So it's a very complex set of issues that stem from deciding whether or not you're dead.
Yeah, it's something really, really difficult to deal with. And I know we had another caller. We're running out of time, but someone who has ALS wondering, how does one identify a doctor who is sympathetic to euthanasia? And euthanasia does come up in your book.
So I think finding a doctor is a challenging prospect for anyone, but I will offer the broader thought that some states allow assisted suicide. The people who benefit most, in my experience, are not people who ever use it. There are people who know it might be an option for them out there. And to what degree do you balance the potential negative impacts of assisted suicide against the potential hope that someone has that if they ever were truly desperate, they would have this outlet? It's a really, really hard one.
Yeah, it really is. Do you think your book will help people in making decisions that maybe don't even involve medical issues?
I hope so. I say the two things I hope my book does. On the one hand, I hope it makes people and society think more broadly about these issues and realize that there's a lot of common ground to have meaningful debate. And then I say more facetiously, it's also a good way to get people arguing with their spouse.
On that note, Dr. Appel, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed your book, and I hope a lot of people read it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jacob Appel, our guest today, his book is called Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and the Concerned. It was interesting and fun talking with him. Tomorrow on the Ideas Network, we'll have our three wildlife writers come by to talk about a variety of wildlife and conservation issues. In the meantime, thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Net.